This is Sam Robson here today with Jeff Bryant. Today's date is April 29th, 2016, and we're in the audio recording studio at CDC Roybal Campus in Atlanta, Georgia. I'm interviewing Jeff as part of the CDC Ebola Responders Oral History Project. So Jeff, thank you so much for being here with me.
Sure.
And for the record, could you please state your full name and your current position with CDC?
Jeffrey Lynn Bryant, and my current position is I am the director for the Division of Emergency Operations.
Great, thank you. And can you tell me when and where you were born?
That is, believe it or not, kind of up in the air. I was adopted out of an orphanage and up in upstate New York. And so my birth certificate is Plattsburgh, New York, but I was not born there. I was born in a little village in central New York. Yeah.
Gotcha. So tell me about your first, few years up through high school.
Yeah. So born in New York, grew up mainly in Georgia, middle Georgia, when Robbins, my dad was in the Air Force, and he retired at Robbins Air Force Base in Georgia. So went through most of all of my school years there, graduated from Warner Robbins High in 78, wasn't going to college, but my girlfriend's dad said I was going to college, and he gave me the money to start school. I got huge grants, basic grants and Pell grants and all that kind of stuff after that. Finished in 82 with a bachelor's in medical technology.
How'd you get an interest in medical technology?
Well, I was pre-med, but got in some trouble in college, and actually got kicked out of college at one point, and not for academics, for stupid 19-year-old stuff. So I was going to stay medical. I've always been interested in science and math and engineering, and so stayed medical, became a laboratory scientist, laboratory professional, medical technologist, and did that out of college in a large research lab in Nashville. I went to college in Nashville at Tribeca College, and then moved to Atlanta to work for the VA Medical Center. But in that transition time, I applied to join the Air Force. And they called me shortly after I came to Atlanta and said, we're ready to bring you on to active duty. Your first duty assignment is going to be Ellsworth Air Force Base in Rapid City, South Dakota. And so growing up in the South, I looked it up on the map, find out where it was, and started my Air Force career there in October 1984.
Okay. tell me about the decision to apply for the Air Force in the first place.
Kid coming out of school, 22 years old. My dad was military. I'd kind of been exposed to that a little bit growing up. And, and I had a friend of mine that was already an officer in the military. He was in the Marines. And this guy lived an amazing life. He lived all over the world, and that was for me. So,
okay.
Yeah.
So what happens after you get to South Dakota?
2 years there, got picked up for my first master's degree out of South Dakota. So they sent me to D.C. to get a master's in immunohematology. So they sent me for a master's degree in essentially transfusion medicine. And so I came out of school in D.C. It was a partnership with Bowling Green State University in Ohio, just south of Toledo. And came out of school. I was still a first lieutenant, but I had my master's and started running transfusion medicine services at large medical centers in the Air Force. So I spent 5 years down at Keesler Air Force Base on the Mississippi Gulf Coast in Biloxi, Mississippi. Went from there to Anchorage, Alaska, and spent 3 years at Elmendorf Air Force Base running the clinical laboratory there. And then my science career ended at that point, and I went into operations, military operations.
Tell me about that transition.
In the Air Force, if you're an officer, you have a chance to go to professional military education. And so they sent me to school. So they sent me for a master's. They sent me to school again. I didn't get it wasn't a degree program this time, but it was for officers that were going to the rank of major or that were already majors. And it's professional military education, so you learn military campaign planning, the diplomatic, economic, social aspects of warfare and conflict, and how to prevent that at all costs using other instruments of power, like the political instrument, the economic instrument, or the information technology. So really it was a course on how to prevent war rather than how to win during a war. And so it was very helpful. But I came out of there and went straight into operations. I went to the headquarters European Command in Stuttgart, Germany, which is ironic because I'll relate back to that for Ebola, believe it or not. But I was in Germany from 97 to 02, and that was during the time where we were transitioning from the Cold War to a post-Cold War era. The Balkans were the hot spot in Bosnia, Kosovo, Macedonia, Albania, so I spent a lot of time there setting up medical capacity and capability for our forces and allied forces, working with many other countries and working with NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, and ended up leaving Europe in 02 as the deputy command surgeon. So I was the number two medic in Europe, which covered all of Europe, Russia, down, and then covered the entire continent of Africa, which has since changed. But at that time, the European command covered, it was 91 or 92 or 93 countries. Yeah, so.
Wow, I didn't know that. That's amazing. I'm interested in this transition from the medical technologies and your background there into operations, but it sounds like there's some crossover too. Am I right about that? That when you went to Stuttgart, you're still involved in the medical side in some ways?
Right. No, it was still scientific. It was still okay. Medical, but it was operational planning. So, for example, we would work with special forces or other traditional conventional units in the military, and there would be a mission that we were going to undertake. And so to do that, there's got to be a medical support plan to go along with every mission, whether it's we're flying aircraft sorties over an area, you've got to plan combat search and rescue. You've got to know where your forward surgical teams are. So it's the medical planning behind an operation. And so that's what we really focused on, in addition to working with the State Department to conduct humanitarian and relief missions throughout Africa and Eastern Europe as well. The medics were low threat, and so if the Defense Department or the State Department wanted to get a foothold in a country that they had not had engagement with in the past, then the medics were often a low-threat solution to get a foothold into an area, show goodwill, help a population, and then start those relationships for follow-on activities later.
Wow. So tell me about anything that you did in that capacity that really stuck out to you.
Well, it would have to be Kosovo. I mean, we were first in Kosovo. When I flew into Kosovo the first time on a Black Hawk, the buildings were still smoldering from the air campaign. It was a 100-hour air campaign. Slobodan Milosevic capitulated. He surrendered. And we were poised in surrounding countries. I don't think any of this is classified. We were staged in Macedonia and other Greece and other countries right around there, waiting to go into Kosovo. Basically, the Navy engineers came in and flattened a mountaintop, and that became Camp Bondsteel. That was the initial foothold for the U.S. military in the province of Kosovo. So there were five sectors. We ran a sector. Spain ran a sector. With other partners, Italy ran a sector, and the UK ran a sector, and so it was a multinational response effort to try and stabilize the region.
And I'm asking this because I know a little bit about your Ebola experience and how you were working with so many partners in coordinating so much stuff. It sounds like maybe you were already doing that a little bit with Kosovo.
Yeah, it definitely prepared me for, you know, really a lot of different international type work. And we worked very closely with non-governmental organizations in the military. They typically want our security and want our airlift. They want our logistics capacity. But you learn who they are. You learn what they're doing. You try to complement what they're doing, not supplant what they're doing. And it's a terribly interesting relationship because they want the U.S. military to help them, but not enough for it to become public because they want to maintain their donor base. And so if they were seen as taking a lot of assistance from the U.S. military, it may hurt their donations. It may make fundraising harder in the future. And so there's that delicate walk between what you can talk about you did for them and what they're willing to talk about what you did for them. And that's just kind of the nature of the relationship between the U.S. military and some of these non-governmental organizations.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds like the politics plays in a really real part in what the considerations have to be because they have ramifications. So,
and I would say, so I've been in the emergency management business now for a while. I would say in every disaster response I've either led or been a part of, there is always a very large political component to the response. Sometimes it gets in the way and sometimes it doesn't. But there's no denying that some local elected official or some governor or some minister in a country is at risk during a crisis situation. And either they're going to come out of it on the other end unscathed or they're not going to come out on the other end unscathed. And so it's always a part of response operations.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about any big decisions that you had to make or any challenging moments in Kosovo or elsewhere?
You know, in the military, it's mission first, people always. I mean, that's kind of how you live, mission first, people always. And, you know, by the nature of being in the military, individuals are kind of putting the mission first, even before their own personal safety sometimes. I mean, I didn't feel threatened very much in the military. I was a medic. I didn't get paid to kill people. I got paid to put them back together. And so, but even with the medics, there's times when the mission comes first. And you understand that going in, and so nobody questions it. There's no debate. There's no arguing. You just kind of understand those are the rules. And so you try to execute a mission when there's acceptable risk and push back on a mission when there's unacceptable risk. And the pushing back part, whether it was with the Defense Department or the State Department, is always an interesting discussion about acceptable risk versus unacceptable risk. And so my toughest decisions in the military came when we were having to make those kinds of decisions or make those kinds of assessments. So, but again, that prepared me well for work later in FEMA, where it was very challenging circumstances after natural disasters, and then, you know, the international response work that we're doing here at CDC.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you mentioned, some of this, I'm sure, is classified, and I don't want to prompt you to go into anything that's classified and say something that is uncomfortable, and you have the opportunity to edit this later. But is there a specific time, a specific circumstance, when you remember having to weigh that acceptable versus unacceptable risk?
Yeah, so let me talk about a training mission we did in Nigeria. So we were working with U.S. Special Forces and others to train Nigerian battalions to conduct their own peacekeeping efforts because we didn't want the U.S. to have to go every time there was a flare-up in West Africa. And so this has been several years ago, so I don't remember the exact number of battalions. But there were some Ghanaian battalions, Nigerian battalions, maybe some Senegalese battalions that were there with us. And we were training them using live rounds, like live mortars, live artillery, live whatever. And so, you know, we were charged with laying down the medical support plan for that. And so you're in an uncertain environment with live ordnance and ammunition. And so you try to plan for that. Our plan was that we needed a forward surgical team in Abuja, and we needed dedicated helicopter support for three remote live fire areas. And the State Department came back and said, look, you know, we've got to consider the economics of this mission. It's an important mission, but that's really expensive. And so there's some tough decisions that have to be made. What's acceptable risk and what's unacceptable risk? And so as it turned out, we got the helicopters because we were gonna say the mission was a no-go because we really thought we had to have this dedicated airlift, rotary wing airlift. Well, sure enough, we had a live training site one day, live fire, an ordnance went downrange and did not detonate. And so we had EOD, Explosive Ordnance Disposal Technicians, that were part of the mission. And their job was to go secure the ordnance that didn't explode. And as these young Army staff sergeants were approaching the weapon, it detonated. And they received life-threatening injuries. And, you know, because of the medical system that we had put in place, one of the individuals ultimately passed away. He made it back to Germany to Landstuhl Hospital, which was the regional hospital in Europe. And the other individual lived. And, you know, so those are tough decisions. I mean, these are young Americans. They're somebody's son. And, you know, that kind of gets back to what's acceptable risk and what's unacceptable risk. And so that was a time where we pushed back. We got what we thought we needed. You know, you can't prevent every bad outcome, but you can be as prepared as possible. And so we think we were prepared as possible. And in this case, it probably saved a young soldier's life.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that. And I like that you also brought up, it sounds like in emergency operations, what I'm learning from you right now is that there are just a multitude of possibly limiting factors to consider, and one of them is funding. One of them is, you know, in a best case scenario, we'll have this, but we might not have the funds, and so you have to engage in that push-pull to make sure that you minimize unacceptable risk, I guess.
Right. Yeah, and if you don't have the resources on you, and you try to find a partner that does. And so that's really what we did during Ebola. You know, we tried to find the right partners, international partners, to help us get through this, and we did. We found amazing partners during Ebola. But even at a state and local level, you know, for domestic responses after natural disasters, you try to find the right partners, whether it's the Baptist Men's Organization, which comes and feeds a whole community, or it's the Red Cross doing shelter management, or, you know, it doesn't always have to be the federal government that does the work. You find the right partner, and you know, it's just a force enabler. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. So at this point, let's see, where are we in your life? You were in Germany. I don't know if we've advanced too far beyond Stuttgart.
So then after Stuttgart, then I went into two commands. I did 05 command as lieutenant colonel. I was a squadron commander down at Moody Air Force Base in South Georgia in Valdosta. I was the squadron commander for a medical support squadron. It supported a hospital with a clinic with lab, X-ray, pharmacy, IT, logistics. That's what the support squadron was all about. Then I went to school again for the Air Force for my third sponsored education opportunity. I got another master's degree from the United States Air War College in Montgomery, Alabama. And this was the same. It was a master's in strategic studies, but it was the same kind of thing. It's not only the military instrument of power; it's the economic, political, etc. It was just a higher level education for senior officers. And I was a colonel by then. I got out of school for the third time and took my 06 command, my group command position, as a colonel, and then retired.
Okay.
Yeah, in 2008.
Tell me about. And it doesn't have to just be about, you know, post-Stuttgart and going back to school, but some people who you would say really influenced your thinking, whether in service or whether in education.
So, you know, early in my career, I can point to a couple of people that were, you know, when I was your age, honestly, quite honestly, we didn't really talk a lot about mentorship. It was not the buzzword. It wasn't sexy to talk about. People just kind of did it under the radar. We didn't talk about it. And so I can point specifically to two individuals that raised me as a young military officer and are hugely responsible for how I turned out today. As you advance in a career, then you find yourself in that role, hopefully, with other individuals. And also as you advance, the pool of people that can continue to help you advance even further becomes a lot more limited, because they're retiring, they're transitioning themselves or whatever. And so I still learn a lot today from people that I work for, but also that people that I work with, you know, that are part of our division. And so, you know, the next generation, the early, the generation that's going to follow me, your generation, they're more talented than we were at that age. And so it's a matter of, I mean, I have a responsibility to help raise them as quickly as they can be raised and exploit them, give them opportunities to exploit their talents and learn and grow. And so actually, that's what I spend a lot of time doing right now. I mean, I'm way closer to the end of my career than the beginning of my career. And people in my position should have a responsibility to keep the pipeline strong and keep the pipeline going. But I also read a lot. And so I think later in my career, it's what I read more than it's an individual that I want to model something after, because we're kind of like peers at this point. And you can also definitely can learn from your own peer group, but it's a different dynamic. And so I'm very judicious about what I read, but I read a fair amount, and I'm willing to explore new models on how to do old things, how to do traditional things with new models. And so even this week, I had a session with the division on a new model that we're going to go forward with on resilience. Resilience is soft and squishy, and nobody knows really how to define it. Well, I came across a model from Johns Hopkins in the last two or three weeks, that was like, that's what I'm talking about. And so we spent an hour with the division talking about that Wednesday. And so it's more that kind of thing at this point in my career rather than an individual that's influential or, yeah.
Cool. Just because you mentioned it, I had Rick Klomp in here like a couple months ago, and I know resilience is a big thing.
Rick's big into that. I don't think Rick's seen this model yet. I've talked to Rick about this model, but he hasn't seen it yet. And so I'm sure we'll partner with Rick at some point going forward with this.
Cool. Yeah. Sounds exciting.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that earlier in your career, you can point to two individuals who were very important.
Right.
Can you talk about them?
Yeah, Colonel Sue Ellen Novak. Sue Ellen is the most atypical, non-traditional military officer you would have ever wanted to have met. She was as comfortable in dress blues speaking to Congress as she was throwing a tomahawk at a Native Indian fair in Anchorage, Alaska. And so, and she looks the part, you know, Sue Ellen looks the part. She broke every stereotype and mold of a female military officer specifically, but any military officer. Sue Ellen broke the mold, and she's an amazing professional, an amazing lady. And she grabbed me by the back of the ear a few times and said, look, son, you know, this is the right way to do this. And I learned so much from her. The second individual is Colonel Mike Caldwell. Mike's a personal friend of mine today, as Sue Ellen is also. But Mike had a completely different style. Mike was a quiet professional, and actually kind of like my current boss, Steve Redd, a quiet professional. But both of them have the ability to tell someone no or deliver bad news in a way that is polished and eloquent. And I learned there's a time and place to be a quiet professional from both Steve and Mike. Mike years ago, Steve currently. Because if you can have that as part of your leadership style, there's situations you'll find yourself in where it just has to be that way. And if you can't be that way, then you're going to fail, or you're going to have an outcome that's less than what you really wanted. And so Mike Caldwell back in the 80s and 90s, and Steve today.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you for that.
Yeah.
And we got to, I think, your retirement from the military.
Yeah, 08. Retired, went to work for FEMA right away.
Okay.
And I was a federal coordinating officer. So FEMA has a cadre of about 30 individuals around the country that are designated by the president to lead disaster responses, delivering federal assistance to a state governor. And so it's the whole Stafford Act, non-Stafford Act response. You know, FEMA operates off of the Stafford Act. This is legislation that actually was just reauthorized about 3 years ago. But the Stafford Act is the process by which a governor of a state, whether it's a tornado or a hurricane, an ice storm, something weird. Flint, Michigan, most recently with the governor up in Michigan. It's the process they use to request federal assistance from the president. They go through FEMA to the president, and the president's the one that grants the declaration. So whenever a governor made a request, the president, if he granted that request, the president would appoint an FCO, a federal coordinating officer, to lead that disaster work. And so I didn't lead the first one that I was in. I was doing a right seat ride. I was in training. But after that, I think I led six different federal disaster responses for FEMA with either with Governor Perry in Texas, Governor Charlie Crist in Florida, or here in Georgia. I led a couple of responses here in Georgia. And that was in 2008 and 2009.
What were some of the disasters that you were responding to?
The biggest one I responded to was Tropical Storm Fay. And in FEMA, if somebody has never heard of your disaster, it was successful. And so if it didn't make the headlines, if it didn't make the news, but Tropical Storm Fay started in the Florida Keys, went all the way up the state, got to Jacksonville, and took a hard left and wiped out the panhandle. So literally all 67 counties in Florida had a disaster declaration. And so I worked on that particular disaster, I think, for over a year. And during that time, then other disasters hit Florida, like Hurricane Gustav, Hurricane Ike, another disaster in the panhandle. So I really lived in Florida. I didn't live in Atlanta. I lived in Florida and worked there for most of the 2 years I worked for FEMA. I worked in Florida.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha. So, and you leave FEMA at what year?
09.
09. What happens then?
Came here.
Okay.
So I was on my fourth disaster in a row in Florida. It rained hard at the panhandle, and it flooded, and I knew I was going to be there for this tiny little disaster. It was big for the populations that got impacted, but in the grand scheme of things, it was a very small disaster, and it was like, you know what? I've had enough of this. And so jumped on the internet late one night, saw a job here at CDC, applied for it, came up to Atlanta for the first interview, went back to Florida, continued the disaster, got called for a second interview. I said, look, I'm sorry, I can't leave the disaster right now. So I did that one. No, actually, I did come back for that one and met for an hour with Len Austin. Len Austin used to be the chief management officer and the deputy for OPHPR. Yeah, Dr. Len Austin. Len's also an amazing lady. And she interviewed me, and they called me for a third interview, and I told them, look, I'm really not your guy. I've been thinking about this job, and I'm really not your guy for this. And so got back on the phone with Lynn at that point and ended up having a third interview with her and Bill Nichols, who was the COO, the chief operating officer at the time. He was that before Sherry Berger. And, after another conversation with Bill and Lynn, I decided to come to CDC and was hired as the management officer for OPHPR.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was there something specific they told you that said, okay, you know what, this is a good opportunity?
Yeah, actually there was. Bill said, look, Jeff, we know this isn't your dream job, but we want you to be part of the agency. Just come and do it for a couple of years, and then just go do whatever you want to do. So that's what I did. I was the MO for like 16 or 17 months, and then I got into more of a – and then I went to the Division of State and Local Readiness. That was much more of what I was used to doing in the past and enjoyed doing, and that was much more of an operational job, operational position. And I worked for Chris Cosmos, who I would put as a mentor as well. Chris is amazing. And I worked for her for 4 years until I have the position I have now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tell me about those 4 years and some of the things you were involved in.
It was all about state and local. It was all about state and local readiness. And so we implemented the branch that I led, the program services branch, we implemented the Public Health Emergency Preparedness Cooperative Agreement. It's the largest preparedness cooperative agreement within HHS. And so annually we gave out about $600 million to state and local public health departments to enhance their readiness posture, increase their preparedness platform, and be ready for a bad event, a bad public health emergency. And so I did that for 4 years. Yeah. I still have amazing relationships at the state and local level with preparedness directors across the country and the territories. Yeah.
Okay. And so that brings us up to, I guess, 2014, or let's see.
Brings us up to 2014.
Yeah. Okay. Gotcha. Well, let's pause for a second on this thing.